Thank you, Dan. Happy Sabbath to everyone. Happy Sabbath to those listening in as well. Judging from the meager turnout, it seems that word got out that I was speaking today, so they even have to feed you, you know. Not even my wife is here. The title of my message today is The Truth Encapsulated. The Truth Encapsulated, in capsule form. Imagine your neighbor comes up to you one day and he's seen you and your family going to the feasts and going to the weekly Sabbath. He's talked to you from time to time and he understands by now that you're a believer in the Bible and a conscientious observer to the best you can. You're helpful. You're honest. And you're a light to this person. Not that you're trying to show off or anything like that, but just trying to sincerely live by every word of God. And so he's having a bit of a trial this day. And he comes up to you and he's stressed. And in effect, he asks you of the reason of the hope that is in you. Now, he's a religious person himself. He's a Protestant. He has certain ideas, certain things that he observes, but they don't do it for him. And he begins to see that they're just kind of a facade. And he wants to know, what is it really all about, though? How could there really be a God, after all, that's loving and all-powerful and allows human beings to suffer the way that they have throughout history and currently? You know, sometimes we, in fact, often we probably lay a ton of information on them, all kinds of scriptures and everything. We go back to the Garden of Eden, even Lucifer's fall and the whole thing, and go through the whole Bible. And then later on, we kind of regret it. We say, I shouldn't have said that much, you know. I could see him yawning and his eyes glossing over, and we thought, that's the wrong approach. Well, you know, sometimes I think the better approach is to just approach it almost philosophically. Now, not the philosophy of the world, but on the basis of God's truth, how can I best encapsulate it? It's not going to be an answer that gives him all the details, gives him all the information he's searching for. Not now. But it does give him the kind of answer that does give him a context, that gives him a context in which, as time goes on and he thinks, and maybe he comes across scriptures, perhaps God is beginning to open his mind, then he'll have something, a matrix, something that he could attach to, a platform from which he can proceed and to build on your answer, on an answer that was perhaps only a few words. You know, we have an example of such an answer like that, of a person that was like that, that came to Jesus Christ. It's not an identical situation, but you all know of it. You all know the story. It's a teacher in Israel, in Judah, at the time. And he came to Jesus by night. And he says, Master, we know that you are a teacher from God. And obviously, he wants some information. What's going on? What do you hear? What are you all about? What is this all about? He taught many people. And yet, to him, it was a lot of do's and don'ts that perhaps didn't really connect with the overall meaning and purpose of life. What's it all about? Sure, I keep the animal sacrifices and the food laws and et cetera. But there's something missing. What is it? What's missing? And Jesus Christ answered him in encapsulated form. And he looked at him and he said, I'm paraphrasing. He says, look at you. He says, unless you're born again, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. So in other words, everything that he could do, that Nicodemus could do and to teach, is of naught. It's like Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, it's vanity unless you're born again. So what is this born again? Now, I'm not going to talk about that in particular, but I'm just using this as an example of an encapsulated answer. I think there are a number of such answers that we could give. I was talking to Helmut when we came in. Helmut had his own answer. He went back and he paraphrased the principle from the Garden of Eden, you know. And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. And I bet you brethren could come up with all kinds of different answers. But that's what we're doing. I think any time we stand up here and we give a message, a sermonette or a sermon, I think it's kind of presupposed. It's as if we're talking to people that had no idea of the truth whatsoever. And in a brief time, we're going to try to lay it out in one way or another. And that's what I'm doing today. So I'd like to kind of have you put you in that position where you're trying to answer somebody who's come to you with that question. What is it all about? And you're going to answer on the basis of something that perhaps you've thought about for a long time. So, you know, I think it really all comes down to this. Again, you can't explain how it all comes down to it. You're going to let him deal with that and think about that maybe for the rest of his life. But he's going to maybe remember that answer. I think Nicodemus remembered what Christ said. He didn't understand what he said. He didn't understand how it made sense. But I think he remembered it. And I think, you know, when he was one of the two men that was burying Jesus Christ and afterwards heard reports, no doubt, that Jesus Christ was appearing and disappearing, you know, and Jesus said that he that is born of the Spirit is like the wind. You can't see him coming. You can't see him going. And then maybe Nicodemus, maybe it clicked on him and he said, he was born again. That's right. He was the firstborn from the dead. So the answer I would give, and you could think of the short answer that you might want to give, or you might think about it this week. You might think about it in prayer and talk to God about it in prayer. But the answer I would give is found in Hebrews 2:10. So why don't you turn over there. That's where I'd like to begin my message. Hebrews 2:10. Now, it's not the whole verse even, but the whole verse says, for it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, and bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. So that's a little bit long for the answer that I intend. I would just take part of that. My friend says to me, my neighbor says to me, what's it all about? That's what he wants to know. And I say to him, what it's all about is God is bringing many sons unto glory. That's what this life is all about. And it will touch every human being eventually. It has touched some already, but only a relative few. Most people never knew anything about it. They lived, they died, but they will. They will know about it. There's another resurrection to physical life. Once again, this physical life is so absolutely important to God's purpose that even though most people have not gone through this purpose, that he will bring them back. They have to go through this step. It's critical. Now, in that answer, that brief answer, bringing many sons unto glory, bringing many children unto glory, we know that there is included things such as this. In Hebrews 12:23, you don't have to turn there. But it talks about the spirits of just men made perfect. Now, these are human beings that went through this process where God touched them and he said, okay, I'm going to start bringing you to glory, like I brought my son to glory. And we know that bringing many sons into glory has to do with the spirits of just men made perfect. These are people that were made perfect. Now, they weren't perfect in the flesh, but when their spirit went to God and that flesh is gone, God was able to accomplish something in their lives that was critical to his purpose for mankind. Another principle or truth that comes to mind is found in 1 Peter 1:16. We don't have to turn there, but be you holy, for I am holy. Be you holy as God is holy. That's part of it. That's what God is trying to do. He's bringing many children into glory, and he's making people perfect, and he's making them holy. But you have to participate in this. You have to know about it. You have to be involved. How do I become holy? What is holy? What is the difference between unholy and holy? What do I do? We have that knowledge. That's the knowledge of salvation. And there's another truth that comes to mind under this, bringing many children unto glory. This is part of it. And it talks about Matthew 5:48 says, "Be you therefore perfect, even as your Father which in heaven is perfect." So we're talking about perfection. And to put this in sharp relief, let's contrast it with the angels. Let's contrast it with, in particular, Lucifer. Now, here were beings that were created. And what we're going to do is I'm going to contrast now the distinction. As God brings many children unto glory, what's involved with that is something that I would like to contrast to what he did not do with the angels. God created the angels by divine fiat, we believe. Just create. They did not go through a preliminary existence where they participated in this process. What is this process? How does it begin? That's what my friend might be talking about. How does God bring many sons of glory? What are you talking about? And I could say to him, and by the way, the key word here is sons. Sons. There's a difference. There's a distinction between the angels and between human beings with regard to that term, sons or children. What is that? What is that difference? You know, someone might say to me, well, Bill, I don't see the difference. I mean, after all, in the book of Job, angels are called sons of God. They're sons of God. Where's the distinction? The distinction is in Hebrews 1:5. Let's turn there. It's a passage that we're familiar with. Hebrews 1:5. For unto which of the angels said he at any time, "You are my son, this day have I begotten you"? First part is as far as we need to go. For unto which of the angels said he at any time, "You are my son, this day have I begotten you"? This, I submit, is a rhetorical question. The point is that he never said it to an angel. No angel was ever his begotten son. What's the difference? The difference involves God's seed. It involves God's seed. And that's part of how and the basis on which God will bring many sons to glory, bring them to holiness, bring them to perfection. It's based on God's seed. As Peter says, it's in 2 Peter, where he says that we are partakers of God's divine nature. So God sows the seed of his divine nature within us. And that's what makes us new creatures. You know, James says, we are a kind of first fruits of his creatures. How so? How would we be first fruits of his creatures? Because God has conceived us. He has conceived us as his children, which means he has mixed and mingled his nature with ours. We have God's DNA in us, spiritually speaking. Spiritually speaking, that's connected with our basic nature that makes us human beings. Not with our carnal nature. And he combines that nature with us. And that's the basis of us becoming holy, of us being made perfect, of being brought to glory. Now we're talking about perfection. Let's turn to Ezekiel 28:15 now. Let's notice something about the angels in this regard. Ezekiel 28:15. Talking about Lucifer. And it says, "You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created till iniquity was found in you." So he was perfect. Well, Bill, what are you talking about? You're talking about we're being made perfect. We go through this physical human life so God can bring us to glory. He can perfect us. And yet here was a being that didn't have to go through this. God created him directly in the spirit realm. Before we get in the spirit realm, we got to go through this process, though. And anybody that doesn't accomplish, that doesn't fulfill this process, he's gone. He's cut off, he or she. You know, if you do not bear fruit, we're attached to the vine, Jesus Christ. If you don't bear fruit, you're cut off from the vine. If you cut off from Jesus Christ, that's it. We were attached to Jesus Christ for the purpose of bearing fruit. So we go through this process in this life, all the hardships and trouble and trial. And here was Lucifer. And Lucifer was made directly, bypassed all of this. Not just Lucifer, all the angels, to our understanding. And they were created directly in the spirit realm. And here it says to Lucifer, without going through the process that we have to go through, it says he was perfect. He was perfect in all his ways. It says, but until iniquity was found in him. And that's the difference. Because I say that he was not perfect if iniquity could be found in him. How could he be perfect if he could sin? He couldn't. God is perfect. God cannot lie, it says. God cannot sin, I believe by extension is true. Because it's a flaw, and God is perfect, and there's no flaw in perfection. God cannot sin because of his nature. So he places that nature within us, and that nature has certain attributes, love, joy, peace, patience, goodness. And we bear the fruits of the Spirit, which is to say, we develop the attributes of God's divine nature because we are his children. We are being formed and shaped in the womb. We are becoming like Jesus Christ. When he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And that will bring to pass God's ultimate purpose for man that was first pronounced in Genesis 1:26, where he said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness. No doubt, that's what he had in mind. He wasn't talking about finishing where man is now and the kind of person that man is now, a being that has a carnal mind that's enmity against him. No, God had in mind a perfect being. And so that's what he's going to bring about. And that's his plan. That's his purpose. And in the meantime, man suffers greatly. And most human beings know nothing about this process. They live and they die. But every man in his own order, as it says in 1 Corinthians 15:22 and 23, everyone will be made alive eventually. Or at least everyone will have that opportunity. So I believe what we're looking at, when we look at where it talks about the perfection of Satan, it still seems like a contradiction. How could he be perfect? I believe he's perfect in this sense. He is perfect as a created being. He is a created being. In other words, his spirit body, so to speak, his spirit body was perfect. It was perfect. There was no flaw whatsoever in his body. How about his mind? No, his mind. There was no flaw in his mind, because if there were, then the sin is attributed to God. God made him imperfectly. He made him where he was almost inclined to sin. It wasn't really his fault. And some people even go so far as to say that. That's absurd. No, God made him perfect. And his free moral agency, he had free will, being a free will, free moral agency. How about the free moral agency? Was it perfect? Absolutely perfect. So that he could choose good, evil, anyway, anything in between. He was an autonomous being that had that power, that ability that God gave him. It was perfect. He just chose wrong. And he chose wrong for the same reason that God, for the reason that God cannot choose wrong, because he did not have God's nature within him. He was already alive without God's nature. But just like the fetus, the human fetus in a womb, it develops, it's formed and shaped. It just doesn't come to human life as an empty shell. That DNA informs and instructs the cells how to progress, how to divide, what assignments, lungs, liver, everything. And that's the way it is with us. We are being formed and shaped in the womb. We are being brought to perfection. But the difference is, when we're perfected, it's not going to be perfected by a perfection by divine fiat. In other words, if God were to perfect us by divine fiat, which is to put his nature within us and then instantly create us and give us life and consciousness at the same time, well, we would be programmed. We would be automatons. But that's not the case, brethren, is it? No, we have a choice, even to the point where we could choose death. Choose life or death, that's our choice. And so we choose, as I mentioned in a recent sermon, every step of the way, we choose. We choose life, we choose to be conceived by God, and we choose to grow. We want to grow. We want to become like him. Whereas I concluded in my previous sermonette that When we are finally in God's family, none of us can say, you know, we never asked to be born. We certainly did ask to be born and strived and struggled and wrestled to develop the attributes of God's divine nature. So that's the difference, I submit, between the perfection, as far as it goes, of a created being. I'm not saying that the perfection was after Satan sinned. He wasn't perfect then. But he was perfect before he did that. But he had free moral agency. But with us, in fact, let's go to one more scripture. I'll close with that. If you go to 1 John 3:9. Now, throughout this epistle of John, obviously, he's talking about people that are, in a sense, born of God. There's a difference. They're obeying God and so forth. And so a lot of people have used this epistle to say that's the extent of born of God. They didn't recognize a kind of a duality here, that John is talking about two senses of born of God. But I believe that in 1:3:9 it makes it absolutely clear that in this instance, John rises above what he's talking about as it applies to this life, and he says this. 1 John 3:9. Whosoever is born of God does not commit sin, for his seed remains in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. God's seed remains in him. By the way, Peter says that we have been begotten again by God's incorruptible seed. So here we are. Here's this seed. He that is born of God, a lot of people say, oh, he does not sin. In other words, it just means that he doesn't sin habitually. He doesn't go back to sin. But they seem to forget, they seem to overlook this one word. It says, he cannot sin. So no matter how you define sin in this context, the person who's born again cannot do it, just like God cannot do it, and for the same reason. Because he has God's divine nature developed within him.